And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. And we invite you to call in tonight with your questions about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press, and he has authored over 70 articles on birding and bird populations. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, thanks again for joining us tonight.
Hey, Bill. Glad to be here.
So once again, we will take your questions tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And also, if you have any photos and you would like Cliff to identify a bird, you can send those to us at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. At the end of last month's program, Cliff, you gave us a conservation tip. Can you refresh our memories about that this week?
Yeah, we talked about seed feeders and the importance of them, and to think about that they're supplemental and not sustenance, meaning if, you know, there are a lot of people that think if I don't feed, the birds are all going to die. You really think that? Because remember, we've only been here so long, and the birds have outdated us by a lot. So just keep that in mind, that supplemental, and that you don't just put up a feeder and you're done. You have to maintain it. You have to make sure it's clean. Feeders are where diseases can be spread and shared. So we want to make sure that that we're doing the right thing. And that's keeping the feeder clean, make sure your food's clean. And what I mean by that is, if you have seed that's stored in a sweaty environment, hot and sticky, like down here in the South, that can be a big problem for birds. So, but another thing, don't gauge bird abundance by what's coming to your feeder. In other words, if you go out to change your feeder, you're used to changing it every few days, and it doesn't need to be changed. Don't think, oh gosh, the sky's falling. Instead, keep in mind that Mother Nature is providing fresh homegrown buffet in the neighborhood that might be keeping your birds very active and busy elsewhere. So but you can learn a lot by watching your feeder, and where else can you really study birds better than in your own backyard?
And this month, as every month, we're going to open up with this month's spotlight. Let's give a listen to this bird. Well, that sounds almost like an insect.
Yep, you can hear some humming, some buzzing from the wing, and then a lot of chatter. So that's the ruby-throated hummingbird. So you heard two things. You heard the wings giving that hum sound, the buzzing sound, and then the chirping was the bird itself. And the ruby-throated hummingbird is the dominant species of hummingbird in the Red River Radio listening area. I'm betting it represents maybe 99% of the hummingbird sightings in our area. And that remaining 1% would be a few species of hummingbirds, like the rufous hummingbird, that would be considered a vagrant to our area. So the ruby throat is named for the male's iridescent throat. It's a body part. The throat, that body part on the male, is also called the gorget, G-O-R-G-E-T. The female doesn't have that color. She's pretty plain. And we're still hearing them chattering at the feeder. Let's listen again. Neat. And since that red throat is iridescence, that means that the angles to the sunlight can play tricks on colors. Caution is advised when that throat is totally black, and what I often refer to as blacked out. Seeing one of these blacked out ruby throats sometimes leads an observer to the incorrect ID of a black-chinned hummingbird, which is typically found west of I-35 in Texas. So we have some records of black chin. They're very unusual, but if you think you have a black chin, make sure you can see the bottom half of the throat, which should be violet in the males. The female ruby throat and the female black chin are extremely difficult to differentiate. It's one of our nation's toughest bird IDs to make. And typical of the hummingbird family, only the female ruby throat does all the nest building, the incubation of the eggs, and the feeding of the young in the nest. The male's only contribution is with copulation and territory guarding. So he doesn't take part of the nesting in any way. So I'm sorry to break the news to you that male hummingbirds, in human terms, we'd refer to them maybe as deadbeat dads. Ouch. Hummingbird feeders should have some red part that serves to attract a hummingbird passing by, just like a neon sign. Or a red ribbon or red handkerchief will do. And the colors yellow and orange work too, but you can't go wrong with red. Your feeder should always contain a brew of 4 parts water, 1 part sugar, never any other kind of sweetener. And so providing a backyard wildscape, and a wildscape is landscaping for wildlife, that's your best chance at attracting ruby-throated hummingbirds, because that wildscape not only gives nectar-giving plants like Turk's cap, salvias, lantana, and crossvine, but it also attracts gnats and other flying insects that make up about 10% of the hummingbird's diet in the form of protein. So they need that protein to survive. The remaining 90% or so is going to be that carbohydrate-rich nectar, which is a sucrose. And so keep in mind, it's not 100% drinking from your feeder. It needs about 10 or 12% needs to be flying insects, little gnats, little flies, and that's for protein. They can't live on that nectar by itself. So, yeah, the ruby-throated hummingbird is a great bird. And then another reason why we picked it for today is this is about when the first birds come back. The first males usually show up when our buckeyes start to bloom red, and there's probably a reason for that. And so any minute, any day, we're going to see, I haven't seen one yet. Maybe someone has seen their first ruby throat, but it's going to be in the next 2 or 3 days that I bet, or less, that I'll see one in the Nacogdoches area. So keep your eye out for the return of the ruby-throated hummingbird.
Well, give us a call tonight if you have seen one in the area, and the number to call in is 800-552-8502. You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, and we will take your calls tonight. We have our first caller online. I believe this is Clyde from Nacogdoches. Clyde, you should be online, and what's your question tonight?
I've actually got two. One is my wife has heard, and then I heard a bird whose call I do not recognize at all. Just heard him twice. She heard it over near the Stern House, near downtown, and I heard it out in the area near our backyard. And it's both in early afternoon, maybe 2:30, and it was a very distinct whoo, and then a second right after, sort of a I didn't do that very well, but that's the best I can manage.
Well, do you think it was a dove or maybe?
No, it definitely did not sound like a dove.
Okay, or an owl.
Major doves, I think.
Okay, because we have a pair of backyard pair of barred owls that have been hooting, but that's, it's not usually just one hoot.
Now, they hooted, you know, about 2 or 3 times, and that was it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and all day long, ours will do it about every hour or two, you know, bright sunlight, and you're thinking, well, that's pretty weird, but it sounds like a
No, it's just a two-note call, huh. One who, and then the second sort of, I want to say a kind of a oh.
Huh. Well, I'm trying to think, you know, doves and owls are the top two that
come to
mind.
And I would have thought dove, yeah. Except that I've never seen doves calling that didn't call a lot more persistently than that.
Right, right. Well, you know, most cell phones now, you can record sounds and even play them back for us in the future. So if he's reliable, like you said, at 2:30, you might get your phone ready.
We just heard it. She heard it one day, and then I heard it over on the near where we live near Bright Coop, and I heard it once, and that's the only times we've done it.
Yeah.
Now, so I don't know if it's somebody who's not you know, actually decided not to live in the area.
Right.
Just what?
Well, now, we have the familiar mourning dove that makes a mournful coo, but there is another dove that's infiltrating our area, and that's the white-winged dove.
Right.
And so we heard one about a week or two ago, and that's maybe only the fourth time I've heard one in the Nacogdoches County area. So you might look to see if that was your bird. Maybe go to the internet and play some white-winged dove.
Okay, I'll do that.
Yeah.
My suggestion gets me going looking anyway.
And if you're not familiar with it, because we don't hear them, that might have, you know, perked your interest and gotten you to listen to it. So maybe try white-winged dove if it's not an owl and not one of our more familiar doves,
you know,
like the mourning
dove. I never think of owls as calling at midday.
Yeah. Yeah, it is strange. And our barred owls are nesting, and I don't really know what all's going on, but it seems like the pair is communicating back and forth to one another.
All right. And would he go to the Cornell Ornithology site? Is that the best site to get to
find
that?
Very good site. Yes, they're very complete. The Cornell Macaulay Library of Sound is very complete, so that would be a good website to go to. Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and he's taking your calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We'll also take your photos at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com. You can also send audio recordings, if you have those, to that same address as well, and we'll get them on the next show. And we're going to go next to our next caller, Sherry from Lufkin. Sherry, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hey, Cliff. I've been waiting for someone else to ask you, but nobody has. But we have almost an acre, and there's lots of holly trees and lantanas that we left to seed like you recommended, all kinds of vines, honeysuckles. So we have all kinds of birds, the woodpeckers, the cardinals, the jays, mm-hmm. you know, the wrens, and we have an old dog. Mm-hmm. And so we put out dog food for the dog. Well, the birds, at first I thought the dog was, that her appetite was just really huge. So we kept buying large bags of dog food at Sam's. And one day I was off and sitting in the back, and I heard a loud commotion, and there were woodpeckers and cardinals and jays all taking dog food.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't care that they were taking the dog food, but I thought it can't be good for them. So I donated that Beneful and then bought bigger Beneful, big pieces of mm-hmm. it, because I thought, well, that'll be too big for the birds to eat. It's not.
No.
They just take it and hit it like it's a nut.
Yeah,
they
like a sledgehammer.
Yeah. I'm just worried I'm doing them harm. And the dog will not, I tried feeding the dog in the house and in the sun porch, but she won't, only place she'll eat is that one spot, you know, with the water bowl.
Yeah.
And you I don't know what to do.
Well, you probably have some of those birds very acclimated to the free handout. I've never read of dog food being a problem for birds. So there are lots of jays and woodpeckers, and if you have great-tailed grackles, they really like dog food. And some of those birds will take it to the adjacent water bowl and even soften it up and then eat it.
They do. I have to change the water twice a day. I thought it was the raccoons at night doing it.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's the birds.
Yeah. I would say, you know, I don't think there's a concern other than your pocketbook. I don't think you're going to be harming the birds.
I was worried that they weren't going to get that they'd be filled up with dog food and they wouldn't get what they needed.
Yeah.
Nutritionally.
They might get too fat. They can't fly and they might start growing hair or something weird.
But.
No.
doing something when they're laying eggs and me causing a problem.
Well, I think it's a good concern to have, and I would still work with the dog and try to figure out his schedule and maybe ration the food more, not just leave a big bowl. If he won't eat inside, you said he's older, he's set in his ways. I can appreciate.
Yes, he's just set in their ways.
I can appreciate that too.
Everything for them to eat. I mean, there's all kinds of climbing roses and honeysuckles and holly, you know, the holly bushes everywhere filled in the lantanas and being, there's just everything for them to eat.
But
you know?
A big nugget of dog food, wow, you can get a lot of bang for your buck.
So. I guess that's it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you then. That's what I was wanting to make sure I wasn't.
No.
You know,
That's good, Sherry. Thanks for the observation.
You're welcome, sir. Thanks for your show.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That's sort of like a steak to somebody who's been eating on ramen noodles for a while.
Yeah.
Well, you are listening to Bird Calls, and you can give us a call tonight. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist, and he is with us from the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. I didn't quite get it. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. We're going to go to our next caller, which is Betty from Shreveport. Betty, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
We're hearing a bird call, went outside and found in a tallow tree one Baltimore Oriole, a male. And he stayed around for about 3 days, and he would fly up to the patio and land on the back of a chair and then fly back and forth across a window that looks into our garden room that's about 20 feet long.
Uh-huh.
And then he'd fly back up in the tree, and I've never seen a Baltimore Oriole. Shreveport, and we've lived here for 40 years.
Was that recently that you saw him?
It was 2 years ago.
Okay, but what time do you remember? What time of the year it was? Because it probably was not March. I can bet. Okay.
No.
Yeah, and we do have them pass through the area. They're very low density breeder in the listening area, but they're very common as a migrant. So I bet you witnessed a migrant that was passing through either in spring, which would be April, May, or in the fall, which would be August, September, October.
Is it common to see just one alone?
Yeah, they don't necessarily migrate in flocks or groups. That you can see singles quite readily. That's not unusual at all. So I'm betting it was migratory, and a single is not a problem. Yep.
He was beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Was it a male? So bright?
Yes.
Okay.
A male.
Yeah. What a stunning bird that is. It's orange and black. I mean, it must be so stunning. We named a Major League Baseball team after him. How about that? Well,
I didn't know that they came to this area. I'm surprised.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks, Betty.
Thank you,
Betty. You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist, and he is with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we're going to be taking your calls tonight at 800-552-8502. Go ahead and give us a call if you'd like to send us a photo of a bird that you have found or photographed and would like it identified. You can send that photo to redriverradiomail@gmail.com. We're going to go next to Jason from Longview. Jason, you're online next. What's your question?
Hi, I was calling to ask. I heard earlier that Cliff said that he had barred owls nesting in his backyard.
Yep.
And occasionally, very early in the morning, around 5 a.m., I'll be outside taking out the trash or something, and I will hear owls off in the distance, and often I'll get my daughters up to come listen to them. We're really fascinated by them. And I was wondering if there's a way to attract those to your yard.
Well, the attraction for our pair is actually in the yard that behind us, there's no fence, and the lady lets us go in the backyard. She has a sugarberry tree, and a limb broke off years and years ago and it, of course, didn't heal. Instead, it rotted out, and so that created a natural cavity, a natural hollow. So that right there is the reason those birds are always right in that area in the springtime, is because of that nest cavity. So, you know, that's not something you can create, but you can get online and look for blueprints for a barred owl box. I made one before one time, and it was massive. It was almost the size of a small dorm refrigerator.
Oh, wow.
And so it took two people to get it up in the tree. Actually, a friend of mine has a tree trimming service, so he's really good at climbing and has all the equipment. So he came over and used all his ability to get up in the tree, and we mounted about 32 feet up in the tree, and it was a booger to mount up in the tree. Barred owl did take to it, but then we found out that a raccoon kicked him out and used it instead. So that's another thing to think about, is that's a commodity. That real estate's really prime for a lot of critters. They want that cavity, so the barred owls are fighting over it with opossums and with raccoons and believe it or not, with wood ducks and a whole bunch of other species. So I would say try to put up a box or two. That way maybe you can have enough boxes up for everybody. What I like to say, free government housing for everybody. But okay. other than that, I mean, you it's not like you can go to the pet store and buy a bunch of rats and let them go and hopefully owls will come to you. I don't know if people really would do that, but there's really not anything else I can recommend except putting up the nest box. And that's a seasonal thing, so that would be a breeding season thing. They're not going to be using it in the non-breeding season. So, yeah, I would try that.
All right. Thanks for your information.
Yep.
And so are most owls omnivores, or are they strictly, carnivore?
They're strictly carnivore. At least our owls, I can't think of any that eat anything else but flesh. There are some in the world that only eat fish. We don't have any of those here. But ours are strictly carnivorous. They really eat a lot of rodents, so that makes owls really good neighbors to have. And in parts of the country, we really try to push that because, people are trying to get rid of rodents. Well, we say, hey, well, you're also, you got rid of all these dead trees or these things that raptors and owls like. You want to make sure you keep your raptors and your owls because they're going to be your best pest control against rodents. So, and a big one are deer hunters. That put up deer blinds in parts of Texas where if they don't have windows or covers or doors, they're just open air deer blind. The hunters will come in the fall to clean it out for deer hunting coming up, and it'll be just littered with owl poop and bones and even sometimes nesting. Barn owls, B-A-R-N, they can nest several times a year mainly depending on the food crop. They can nest any season of the year. So sometimes that hunter will come to clean out the deer blind and oops, there's an owl living in it. So if you don't want that, make sure you cover your blind, have doors that close. Otherwise it's just great real estate for somebody that wants to get out of the sun and the rain and safe from predators. But owls, in a nutshell, owls are good neighbors to have. They're eating a lot of the things we don't like.
So we're talking about natural squatters.
Yeah.
Right there. Yeah,
so. Yeah, that's right.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with Cliff Shackelford. He is our resident ornithologist, and he is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We're going to go next to Judith from Tatum, Texas. Judith, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Thank you. I'm kind of a newbie with birds, but in the spring and the fall, there's like a river of small black birds. When they come to earth, they blanket it and cover it so that the grass looks black. I just like to know what kind of bird that is.
Yeah, and they really peak in February, March. If we're on the same page, those are going to be common grackles.
Okay.
They're all black. If the light hits them just right, they can be there's iridescence involved, so they can look purpley, they can look bronzy, they even have a golden look at certain angles. But in the shadows, they're just flat black. And so common grackles will push through our area in big numbers. Again, in February, March is when I really see big numbers where they can just like you just perfectly like you described, they just blanket the ground, make it look black. And so those are migratory birds. They're going to they nest here locally in small numbers, but the vast majority of them are just passing through. So in February, March, they're already headed to points farther north because most of those birds are going to breed farther to our north. But some will stay. But again, those are common grackles, not to be confused with great-tailed grackle. That's a different species that we have at some of our Walmarts in really urban areas. They really like pavement. These guys are really more into the grass and in lawns than the great-tailed grackle. And they all look the same. That's another distinction is great-tailed grackle, the male and the female don't look alike. He's bigger and iridescent black. She's smaller and a flat brown. But when you see common grackles, they're all the same in shape, size, and color.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you, Judith. You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8255. 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we're going next to Douglas from Marshall. Douglas, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hey, Cliff, that was a really good Bart Owl call you did there at the first of the show.
Great.
I can't do it that good with my call. I was wondering, the pileated woodpecker, are they a nester or do they live in dead trees?
They have to have a cavity.
Right.
Now that cavity can be in a live tree or a dead tree, but most often it's going to be dead wood. So it can be a live tree with a dead stub, and mm-hmm. they'll nest in that because it's so much easier to excavate in dead wood.
Right.
So it's a little misleading to say that it has to be dead trees, because a lot of times they'll find nests in a living tree, but one limb over there is dead.
Right.
And they'll take to it.
Okay.
So, and the problem with nesting in dead wood, it doesn't last very long. So typically they only get a year or so of use out of it, and then they've got to move on. But going back to how I said how easy it is to excavate, they can just move on to another dead stob or a snag and just start over mm-hmm. and build a new cavity. So they pileates also use those cavities to roost in at night. Roosting means sleeping. So they use those every night to sleep in. There's a lot of safety and security by doing so. But, yeah, dead wood is really important for pileated woodpeckers. And then when you're a big woodpecker like that, you're going to have a larger diameter tree, right?
Right.
So big trees are pretty important to the pileated for nest cavities. Yeah.
I saw my first hummingbird last year, March 23rd.
Okay.
I looked at my calendar, and I work in Carthage. I went straight back to work that Monday morning and put up my feeders, and they were there that day.
Oh, that's great, and that's really cool that you wrote it down and you knew where to go to look for it, because I think that's a lot of fun. Because mm-hmm. we scratch our heads. We're like, well, when is that one going to be back? I don't remember. And memory just won't serve you well, but notes really do. So that's really cool that you're writing stuff down. And I encourage that for everybody to write stuff down when they see things in their backyard, like you did the first hummingbird of the season. That's really fun to do. And then it's fun to be, you know, self-competitive and say, I'm going to do better next year. I'm going to, you know, see if I can see one a day or two earlier than that. You know, it's timed with your work schedule and when you're home and when you're looking. Mm. So, but that's great. Keep taking notes. That's really fun.
I won't keep you longer. Just one more question.
Sure.
Owl box you talked about, yes, they are big. Would you recommend putting those on a utility pole or not?
A utility pole would be a lot easier to put it up. I would, and you know, the reason I hadn't really thought of this, but to keep the, if it's not approachable from above by a climbing raccoon, you could put some flashing on the base of it to keep
right.
the mammals out.
That would be the whole idea.
Yeah, so that would knock out the biggest competitors right there. So not everybody has that option. Now, if the electric company owns that pole, they're going to have problems with it if they ever have to service that pole. I've talked to people that work there, and they have to knock them off.
Mm-hmm.
So if you own the pole, then you can do it. Or if you have the luxury of putting up a pole that's just for this, man, that's great. But okay. just keep that in mind. If it's a public utility pole, and even though it's on your place, they have a right-of-way, and you shouldn't be tampering with it.
Right.
And I don't want people getting near power lines for sure.
Right.
But if you've got that option, go for it. And put that flashing up, and that'll eliminate the coons.
All right. Thank you
cool.
very much.
Thank you, Douglas.
You're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. And he can be reached tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. With any calls about our avian world, we're going to go to next to Steve. Steve, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. This is Steve. I've had a question that's been bothering me for a long time. You know, you can watch old films. You can see these things. And you can hear in the background Mr. Bob White Quail just blowing away and
yeah.
having a good time. And you don't hear Mr. Bob White Quail anymore. I don't hear him anywhere I go, whether it's Georgia, Tennessee, Arkansas, Louisiana. I just don't hear him anymore. What happened, Jerry?
Steve, remind me where you're calling from?
El Dorado, Arkansas.
Okay. Yeah, and that's a problem that has been really going, it's really plummeting, that species in our listening area and really the whole Southeast. It's basically been extirpated from much of its range. We've basically not done very well maintaining their native grass habitat. That's the big problem. Instead, we've converted it to non-native grasses that are more of a carpet grass that would put the quail on top and running around, whereas they'd rather have the native bunch grasses where there's bare ground that they can run around in between the grasses and therefore stay hidden. They don't like to be on stage. And so that's the big problem with quail. And all the quail hunters know that. There's really just, for Texas and really nationally, for the South, there's really just two big strongholds left, and that's the South Texas area and also the Wichita Falls area. And there's pretty good strongholds there, and that's because land ownership is large, and landowners are keeping it in native for the most part. And that those are two huge keys for Bob White. So Bob White won't do well if you only own a few hundred acres. You've got to think big real estate to have quail. So you got to have 5,000 acres minimum before you can even start considering having quail. And that means 5,000 acres of native grasses. And that's just super rare in the Southeast now. It's almost gone. We've completely wiped out the quail's habitat in most of its range.
It sounds like we've just about completely wiped out the native grasses, too.
Yes. Yeah, the native grasses that are, you know, acclimated to that soil, to that weather condition, that don't need copious amounts of nitrogen and watering and more fertilizer and more care, that it was just the grass you left alone. So, you know, a lot of people that have hay meadows, which might have been 80 or 100 acres that they didn't mow and didn't convert, those areas right now are some of the last relics of tall grass prairie in parts of Texas. But now in the Southeast where we are, the grass would have been under a canopy of pine that was sparsely stocked, very open pine. In other words, you could almost throw a football or frisbee in those forests and not hit a trunk of a tree. The trees were that far spaced because you needed light to hit the ground for those grasses and those forbs to flourish. So we've done away with that. We've cut all those trees down. We've stocked them, super stocked them with lots of trees, and no light gets to the ground, no grass grows, and no quail. So it's really hard to describe to people that quail aren't out in those pastures that we put into coastal Bermuda for cattle. People see those grasslands and say, well, we have grasslands, why don't we have quail? It's not the right grassland. Right. Mm-hmm. It's not the right grass. It's not the right configuration. It's all wrong. And that coastal Bermuda is an old world species. And here we're taking something from the old world, bringing it here and expecting quail and meadowlark and loggerhead shrike and Henslow sparrow and a whole bunch of others to adapt and change, and it just doesn't happen. So we've done it to ourselves.
Well, that's pretty depressing. Thanks.
Sorry about that.
and I hate having to be the messenger and the bearer of bad news, but that's such a hot topic, and the quail biologists all know it. But there's really nothing you can do unless you own and operate the land.
And you did give a conservation tip a couple of months ago about planting native grasses if you're, you know, taking over a property or you want a landscape or something like that to bring back some of those natural species.
That's right.
And natural habitats.
That's right. And I probably will talk about it more in the future. And so I'm glad that, Steve, you brought it up because it is a huge topic. And people that have lived here their whole lives and they're, you know, 60, 70, 80 years old, they notice that the bird's gone. It's it's the newbies that move here that don't, their barometer starts when they get here, and when they get here, there's no quail calling, so they didn't know what was here before a century ago or half a century ago. But
30 years ago even. It's just amazing how quickly
exactly. And so talk to a quail hunter, they'll tell you that they have to travel a long way to hunt quail in a natural setting. Now, I'm not including the put and take situation where you can buy a hunt, go to a place where they release cage-reared birds. They release them maybe a few hours or a day before you get there. That's not the same. And I think the hunter certainly knows it. And also, I want to put a shout-out that that's not a way to put quail back. That these pen-reared birds, we don't know enough about them. They could be bringing disease. They could be actually adding to the problem. So I think that we have to get the habitat back before we can get the quail back. And that means we've got to get fire back on the landscape. We've got to get native grasses back. And it's a huge effort and a very expensive effort to do so. And it is depressing, but I'm glad you brought it up because we need to realize that these changes are affecting a whole bunch of things, especially these grassland birds, and not just birds, but grasshoppers and other critters too.
Well, I sure appreciate your time. Thank you, Steve.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. Cliff is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and he's taking your calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We did have one question that was sent in. Phil from Minden bought a bluebird house and would like to know if he should put it on a tree now because he doesn't want scavenger birds to take over the house. So would this be a good time to put that house up?
Well, a scavenger bird would be a vulture that eats dead stuff off of the road. So I think he must mean a non-target. And that's part of it. I think when you put up a bluebird box, you have to be prepared that maybe a chickadee or maybe a titmouse will use it. And that's cool. We put up two boxes in our yard, and we've had bluebirds using it. And the next year, chickadee might use it. But actually, the bluebirds have probably found where they want to nest already, believe it or not. They really start scouring cavities and nest boxes in February. And so I would say it's really never too late, but get it up now and hope for the best. But you really want to have that stuff up before February 1 because they're really looking for it. But put it up now because then it will be up for 2017,
And something else may nest in it.
Something else might use it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then if you're worried about the other birds, the non-targets using it, just put up a whole bunch of bluebird boxes, and that'll appease everybody.
You have lots of birds.
Yeah.
You're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio. If you'd like to give us a call, call in at 800-552-8502. We go next to Steve from Bernice, Louisiana. Steve, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, yes. You made me think of two. When you were talking about the pop lights up, I've taken to eating quinoa here lately, and that looks like bird seed. I don't know what's in birdseed, but can you throw that stuff and get it started around the place?
And what is it?
Seeds, too.
What are you talking about again?
You don't eat quinoa yet?
No.
It's kind of the latest craze on health foods. It's a South American grain that the Indians have been eating. You can get it at Walmart.
Oh, it's one of the ancient grains. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, now you wanted to spread that out for birds.
I'm wondering, would it grow around here? Would that be a good thing if you did try to get it growing?
I don't think so. I think that the native grasses I'm thinking of for quail are going to be little blue stem, Indian grass, big blue stem, brown paspalum, just a whole bunch of other species that switchgrass. So no, I think the things that we have domesticated and used for agriculture, that's not going to be the trick. So I wouldn't recommend that. Instead, I'd look for just little blue stem. It's the dominant, and it grows in clumps. It leaves these little runways for birds to run around like quail, and that's what's really lacking.
Chia seeds are really small, but the quinoa is a larger seed. But also, about a year ago, these blackbirds that are all up and down I-20, I know from Shreveport to Dallas, a lot of people think they're crows, but I want to call them a grackle or something like that, because there are swarms of them.
Yeah, that's probably the great-tailed grackle.
And Anyway, just about any parking lot along I-20 there, they'll land on the cars and stuff.
Yeah, that's the Great Tail Grackle, and he's got that big, great, long tail. That's where he gets the name Great Tail Grackle.
Well, I had to go to the doctor over in Bossier last year, and I noticed that the birds were real ratty-looking. All the feathers had fallen out of their heads, and it makes them look a lot smaller birds.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we see that a lot more in July. You'll see the males lose all their tail feathers, and that's molt. And they look funny when they fly because they look more like a football than a long, skinny bird that they typically are. So you're probably seeing molt. If all the feathers are gone, it's usually going to be just annual molt.
Well, when I was a kid, my grandmother had a problem with chicken mites one time. I just wondered if maybe there were so many of those black birds that maybe they had some kind of a mite or something.
Yeah, there are, you know, mites and lice are a big problem on birds. But, you know, I'm not a veterinarian. I don't know enough about that to comment. And I don't think even a vet can look at a bird from afar and tell. But most of the time when we see featherless birds like in June, the cardinal that has no head feathers, that's molt and is expected. So I think you should just maybe hope for the best and just consider it that one time they're changing feathers, because feathers are pretty fragile and need to be replaced once or twice a year, depending on the species and depending on the feather.
The reason it bothered me is because they do light on people's cars, and I wouldn't want them spreading mites all over the cars to people.
Yeah, and the critters that are attracted to feathers don't switch to mammals typically. So a feather mite is called that because it needs feathers. So the louse too, the lice, they're specific. Some are specific to certain groups. There's some that are just on owls, and they don't transfer to humans. So I wouldn't worry about that. Yeah.
Well, good to know.
Yeah. Right. Okay, thanks, Steve.
So that's ecology doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves.
Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Clay from Marshall. Clay, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, Mr. Cliff. I've got a bird. It's a... It's a night bird, but it may be at like 12 o'clock at night or so, but it's got a real high-pitched whistle.
Uh-huh.
And then it's just real eerie. I mean, it's the most eeriest thing I've ever heard. And I was able to call it up several times, but I try to get a recording of it, and I cannot get a recording of it. I mean, I go out there with my phone, and it's like it knows I got a phone, but it's a real high whistle. It starts out kind of low, and then it goes.
Huh. And where do you hear that? You hear that in the Marshall area?
Yes, sir. Marshall, Jefferson.
Okay.
And, I know we got whippoorwills, but I was wondering if maybe it's a whippoorwill or
what time of
reach out or something.
What time do you hear it? What time of the year?
Well,
do you hear
it can be 10 o'clock at night. It can be 12 o'clock.
But year round, I mean, is it seasonal?
No, well, no. I mean, I've heard it in the wintertime.
Okay.
I've heard it.
I'm guessing what you're hearing is the screech owl, and the name is not really good because they don't screech. They do more of a whinny, and it's. Let me see if I can do it. Let me take a sip of water here.
Kind of a clucking sound too?
No, not a clucking sound.
Well, I've heard screech owls, and they will screech. They will scare the heck out of us.
Yeah, the barn owl to me does a fair better job of screeching and screaming.
Really?
Yeah, and that's going to be a tough bird to find in the Marshall area. But they're there in low densities. You go farther north towards like Mount Vernon, Sulphur Springs, you start picking up barn owls a lot more. But I'm guessing it's an eastern screech owl and it's a whinny, it's a whistle. It sometimes you almost imitated it pretty well.
Yeah, it goes up real high, you know.
It
starts real low and then it goes up real high. But then I also heard it afterwards. There'll be a kind of a clucking sound, you know, like maybe a female clucking or something.
Yeah,
you know? Maybe she maybe, looking for a mate or something, or he's looking for a mate.
Maybe, yeah. Sometimes the owls will slap their bill if they're upset. So maybe if you called one in, he might be agitated and clapping his bill, snapping his bill. I'm not familiar with that, but no, I'm guessing you have Eastern Screech Owl. They're little. They're about the size of a 12-ounce soda can.
Okay. They're small. Then,
yeah,
huh?
And you're, okay. You know, and probably when you call one in, he's probably looking at you, but hidden. He's looking at you. You just can't find him.
Oh, yeah. I know he can see me. I know where he is, but I've called him. I've called him up, you know.
Yep. And they're good neighbors to have. They eat small rodents. They eat roaches. Moths, large grasshoppers. So, yeah, Eastern Screech Owl is a good one to have, and those sounds are pretty neat. It's just a neat sound at night.
And so that, you say the barn owl makes the screech.
Oh yeah, really.
Many of them.
Just a really loud screech, and then the barred owl we talked about earlier that hoots that I imitate the hoot. On a rare occasion, they'll give out a scream that sounds like some old lady's getting attacked.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it's just a scream. I can't even do it. But it's more like a, wah! I can't even do it.
They used to say the panthers, you know, used to be around here, you know.
Yeah.
They would sound like a woman crying or something.
Yeah, yep. And so I think a lot of people that go camping, if they hear those sounds, they probably pack it up and go home.
Or a coyote.
I mean, it's an eerie sound.
It is.
It really is.
Right.
It's ghostly is what it is.
Yeah, it is ghostly. Yep. Pretty
anyway,
cool.
All right.
Thanks, Clay.
Thank you, Clay. And you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You still have time to get your calls in at 800-552-8502. We go next to Ra from Shreveport. Ra, you're on the line with Cliff. What's your question?
Hello. We've been getting a whole lot of rain and water, and I expect we're going to have a whole lot of mosquitoes pretty soon. Like to know if it's too late for me to start putting up purple martin houses.
Well, I hate to tell you that purple martins aren't big mosquito eaters. And that that was a really successful campaign several decades ago.
To put
martin houses up to eat mosquitoes. They don't eat a whole lot of mosquitoes. Actually, they eat a lot of dragonflies, and dragonflies are your better mosquito control. So if your wetland area can attract dragonflies, when they're in the larval stage in the water, those will eat larval stage mosquitoes. And then when both hatch and come out, the adult dragonfly will eat the adult mosquito. But, you know, we live in such an altered environment that we create these situations where we get bombarded with mosquitoes just the way we've tilled the land and the garbage that holds water. Everybody's familiar with old tires, how that can be just a cesspool for mosquitoes. So I think it's really tough to look for a bird or a dragonfly to really do a lot of help. Instead, I would say just really scour your property and get your neighbors to do the same thing, to dump any buckets holding water, tires holding water, anything like that. Even your gutters, your storm gutters, if you haven't cleaned them out, water can just half a cup full of water sitting in your gutter can be just a mecca for breeding mosquitoes. So I think we just have to do a better job, and I think everybody's got to take responsibility. And for people to say we need to bring back DDT and all these harsh chemicals, it is not the fix. It's not going to help. It's actually going to do more damage. We're going to take 10 steps backwards, trying to eliminate something that we're not going to eliminate with chemicals.
And we will eliminate birds that we do want around.
Yeah, that's right. And then we're going to eliminate all the birds that are eating other critters, other insect pests. What are we going to do then? Right. So it's just going to be a snowball effect. So I think every homeowner, every human just needs to be a little bit more active on getting rid of all that standing water if they don't want mosquitoes. It's a tough job, though. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Rob.
And I know where I'm from, the DDT killed off all the predator birds, the raptors. Now they're all coming back since we've gotten rid of that. The bald eagles. And there was just a story today on Morning Edition about two nesting bald eagles in Washington, D.C. And they had a couple of eggs. So they are coming back, as you know, slowly and surely. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. And you can call in right now at 800-552-8502. We're going to go next to Bill from South Bossier. Bill, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Please, it's South Bossier Parish.
South Bossier Parish. Thank you.
I've got, actually, whenever you said that on the last, I threw in another question. But let me go ahead and get to this. I've got some wrens, and they're a lot of fun to watch and this, that, and the other, but I've lost, the past year, I've lost two nests to snakes. One of them was on a post, and the other one was in a sort of a chair fixture. And the reason why I know it's snakes because one of them actually shed its skin inside the nest. Is, besides putting Vaseline on the post, is there a good snake repellent but without hurting the birds?
The metal flashing, if you've got a post, that's going to be your best, easiest way to do it. It looks like a skirt.
Yeah.
You can go online and find directions of how to cut that metal if you don't want to buy one pre-made, and fasten that to the post, and that will keep your snakes out. Typically, the Vaseline, I don't know that would have much of a shelf life. You've got it's going to be a nasty mess. It's going to catch a lot of insects crawling around and flying around, and it's not going to last long. So that's not a good solution. But I think the metal flashing is going to be your best bet, and that should help you keep the snakes away. Now, there is a bird that nests in our area that actually lines its nest with a fresh snake skin, and they try to have that snake skin hang out of the hole, and that's the great crested flycatcher. So, but you'd probably know that because it's so vastly different looking than a wren. And so they wouldn't use a wren-sized box. They're about almost cardinal size, roughly. Yeah, they're cardinal-sized birds, so they need a larger box. But what's cool is that they have snake skin typically hanging out of the cavity, and the thought is maybe that they're doing that to bluff predators, that there's a snake in there. And it must work, but not everybody does that, just the great crested.
Now, where I live is out in the woods anyway, and I have a hard time about keeping squirrels out of bird food.
Yeah.
And what I've done in the past is using cayenne pepper, because from what I understand, it does not affect the birds. Well, it doesn't seem to work either on the squirrels. I mean, they'll still eat it.
Yeah.
How much do you have to use of that type of thing?
I think the better solution is to get a squirrel-proof feeder, which is not always squirrel-proof. The ones that have a cage around the feeder that the squirrel can't get through but the birds can. But we found that squirrels can still, with a lot of effort, can still get their hand through there and work it, but it's a lot more effort than just an open cupboard, so to speak.
Okay, so, I have a problem with chiggers, and I use a wetted sulfur dust on the yard, but I get concerned about affecting, let's say, rabbits, and I'm not worried about the mice because I got plenty of mice. But the rabbits and also birds that actually feed off the ground, does that affect them?
Yeah, I wouldn't do a broad application. If you got a problem with chiggers, I would think keeping the grass mowed short usually eliminates chiggers. They like taller grass. And maybe just work on your own socks when you're about to go out. Just do the sulfur trick.
Yeah, I have to do that. And you, again, I live in the woods, so as far as a yard, I don't know if you'd call it a yard. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
A lot of leaves, a lot of brush, a lot of trees, that kind of thing. But I have to do something because they eat me alive.
Yeah, and they, as you know, they typically like tight spaces like the elastic area of your sock. If you sit down, they really like the elastic area of your underwear. So since you live in the woods, maybe go naked.
Well, and one other thing that's unusual for my area is probably more native to Texas. It seems like I'm in Scorpion Central, and because I have to use glue traps inside the house because they'll squeeze out underneath and all that kind of stuff. Is there the local birds, are there any of those besides chickens or guineas that eat scorpions?
We mentioned the screech owl earlier. They will eat scorpions. And I'm not familiar with a whole lot of other things that, that will eat scorpions. I think woodpeckers will, because scorpions are up in trees, too, and in rotting dead wood. They'll eat those as well. But there's not a whole lot that'll target them. So really just running those traps is probably your best bet right there in the house and checking your shoes before you put them on. So that's all I have to recommend.
You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, and we're going to get to our final caller tonight, Willie from Shreveport. You're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight? Hello, Willie? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Sorry, this is Willie from Nacogdoches.
Yep.
Okay.
Sorry, Cliff, I just wanted to say hello. We're actually your neighbors right behind your house.
Oh, great. Oh, excellent.
Yes. You'll probably hear our chickens, and we probably hear you calling the owls at night.
Oh, cool.
We know you because of our neighbor, but we love your show, and we wanted to ask you, we have two chickens, and we want them to stop being broody. How do we get them to stop?
How to be what?
How to get the chickens to stop being broody.
Well, you know, I don't do domestic birds. I'm not a chicken expert, so, yeah, I'm not going to be able to help you with that, so...
No worries, Ben.
Yeah, so I don't know what to tell you. You're going to have to ask a chicken farmer, and that's not me. So, but
well, another thing that we wanted to ask you too, because we have a family of owls that live in our trees.
Uh huh.
How we rarely see them, but I heard you talking about it earlier, and trying to bait them out and trying to view how what's the best possible time to actually view them.
Well. You know, the best time is at night. When any of us in our family, my wife especially, when we go walking at night, my wife does that a lot. She'll see them on the wires along the streets in our neighborhood near a light. The lights are attracting insects. The lights are maybe an easier way for them to see stuff. They don't need the light, but it's also the way that we're going to see the owl. So I'd say just walk around at night, 9, 10 p.m., pitch dark, and watch the wires. The barred owls are sitting up there often.
You have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist, and we're going to close out this month's show with this month's conservation tip.
And on this tip, we're going to talk about operating and maintaining a hummingbird feeder. Last time was a seed feeder, so we're going to do hummingbird feeder. And in this episode, we're going to cover proper use and maintenance of hummingbird feeders. So simply mounting a hummingbird feeder does not mean you're done. To keep your hummingbird safe and healthy, consider these tips. Regularly cleaning your feeder is critical. At a minimum, do this a couple times per month. Hot water and a scrub brush or pipe cleaner will do. You want to avoid harsh chemicals and soaps. If your feeder doesn't come apart for easy cleaning, pitch it and buy a new one designed to come apart for easy cleaning. Use a feeder with red parts used to track hummingbirds, or hang a red ribbon or handkerchief. Also, yellow or orange will do. Be sure to brew nectar that's 4 parts water and 1 part sugar. Never use any other type of sweetener. And never use that red dye. It's artificial food coloring. It's never part of a hummingbird's diet. Even though they sell it, don't use it. During the hot summer months, change out the nectar every 3 or 4 days because it'll spoil here in the deep south. Some people have the bad habit of changing the nectar only once it's been drained. Find a shady spot instead of hot sun to mount your feeder. Place your feeder several feet away from the window or shrubs because birds can fly into windows, and shrubs are great hiding places for cats. Fall migration is when we have our most impressive season for hummingbird numbers. And that's a peak in about the latter half of September. And that's when many of our nation's ruby throats are passing through the Red River radio listening area. So feed your hummingbirds responsibly so that we can continue enjoying our birds.
Thanks again, Cliff, for joining us this week. And you have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. He is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we'd like to thank everybody from the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and everybody who called in tonight for helping us out with a great show. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Our producers are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, and we had help tonight from Wally Derleth, Renee Moran, Henry Edwards, and Al Villarreal. The audio for this tonight's episode will be posted on our website in the next couple of hours, and you are listening to Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS. This is KDAQ Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Magnolia, and KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches.